We all know that the role we prepare for early in life will only be the beginning of our story. We will likely move through multiple different types of employment and have a range of different types of working arrangements, possibly full-time, sometimes self-employed, as an entrepreneur or a gig economy worker. We'll likely cycle through all of these. So it's clear that we'll all need to be prepared to learn new skills and build new networks constantly throughout a long working life. But how do we prepare to be future capable, and what role do universities play in this process? Professor Ruth Bridgestock has researched all these issues. She puts forward the idea that we all need to think about the idea of being key-shaped. That is, we need to have a number of areas of technical depth, but also a number of areas of interest where we play and dabble. Ruth is currently National Teaching Fellow at Queensland University of Technology and has just accepted a new role as Dean of the Faculty of Education, Arts and Social Sciences at the University of South Australia. Welcome, Ruth. So for the listeners, we've got Ruth in her last week as a Queenslander, so she's made the choice to go to South Australia. So tell us about the role that you're currently in, Ruth, and the role that you're going to.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So at present, I am Associate Professor within the Creative Industries Faculty here at QUT, and I've just completed a National Senior Teaching Fellowship called Graduate Employability 2.0. I'm moving to the University of South Australia to move into a Dean Learning and Teaching role and Professor of Higher Education. On to new exciting adventures and more skills for me.
More skills.
Yes.
So Ruth just shared with me that that this is, when I asked her why she was making a very poor choice to leave Queensland, that she said it was the next thing for her to learn. So I think you've sort of following your own advice, Ruth, about sort of taking destiny into your hands in terms of your learning. So your themes are very much about continuous learning through our lifetime and through our careers. So that's kind of what guided you into the next role, is what you needed to learn for your next step.
Oh, yes, most definitely. My research very much suggests that the absolute number one thing that we can all do is keep learning, whether formally or informally, and just accumulating skills and capabilities as we go with all of our experiences. And my own career is no exception.
Well, you know, it's really interesting. I often wonder whether when we ask sometimes our students, where are you going to be in 5 years? Whether that's a very helpful question anymore, whether we just learn the skills that we feel we need to learn to, so that we have multiple options. Am I on a good track there?
Yeah, that sounds about right to me. Mm. I mean, my advice to people is very much pursue what you're interested in and what feels right next to learn, because we're never quite sure exactly what the next opportunity is going to be. For a while there, and I have a background in career development learning, and I was a careers consultant for a while, and there's a lot of emphasis in that field about coming up with a career plan for yourself and even writing down specific plans and goals and these sorts of things. But from my experience, I've discovered that, you know, life and careers are in so much flux that doing that sort of thing can sometimes shut you down a bit. And what I tend to do now is follow my nose. It's all about happenstance. You know, I know roughly what I'm interested in, the kinds of skills that I want to acquire next, and let's see where that takes me. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, your role with, so it's graduate skills that your role was looking at. Mm-hmm. So I know that the dean of our faculty, the last gathering had, she said, we have to be aware, you know, we educators, that we're preparing our graduates less for jobs and more for work. And I certainly know what she means by that. But how would you interpret that sort of statement?
Oh, it's a great statement. It's very affirming to my research as well. So, I mean, this goes back to...
I'm in the Faculty of Business, I'm going to tell you. But it doesn't really matter what faculty, you know, like graduates, you know, across the university, the advice would be the same.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. No matter what field you're in, and this goes back to my PhD research. What I did in my PhD was I looked at what are the key skills and capabilities that people need in order to be successful in their careers. I was particularly interested in people in the creative industries because at that stage, creative industries were sort of seen as the most insecure kinds of job roles that you could get. You know, the task of self-managing one's career, the portfolio career and so on, underemployment, etc. But increasingly, we're seeing this in all industries, whether that's science or manufacturing or business or engineering. The traditional organisational career is breaking down. And we're all tasked far more to self-manage our careers. And that includes the learning within those careers as well. So I view very strongly that higher education and formal education generally in the post-compulsory space is there to prepare you for a wide range of possibility. So even if you're doing a vocational or a professional program, like nursing or like engineering, it's likely that you're not going to end up in that career forever. The latest statistics that are coming out are indicating that people have 14 careers during their lifetimes. Not 14 jobs.
Yeah. And then I've often wondered what constitutes an actual, you know, how we define the career exactly. Mm. So, because I think it's not easy because I think moving from one career to another often depends on our, and I know you'll come to this later, about your networks, mm-hmm. you know, and your social mm-hmm. networks. So actually finding that new network that will pivot you to an actual new career is not actually that easy. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Definitely. Mm. This is the top question that I get from master's students, master's coursework students who are coming back, wanting to upskill and retrain to move into a new area. They say, "How do I build those networks? And how do I build that social capital?" Mm. And I think the beginning of the answer there is first of all to do with your own identity. It's going, okay, I'm now viewing myself as an emerging, insert new profession name here. And then it's about putting yourself out there, taking that risk and going to those networking events, as scary as they are. I think everybody finds them scary.
Oh, absolutely. So if you're out there, if you find them scary, you're not alone. Yeah, looking into a room where you don't actually know people and doing networking in an intelligent way, you know.
Absolutely.
And not in a superficial way. It's, it's so important.
Yeah. Mm. And it's about having that initial and yet genuine connection with somebody else who is interested in similar sorts of things to you. Mm. I think it's also about having an online presence that reflects both what you can do now and where you want to go. So it's perfectly okay to be a bit aspirational in your LinkedIn profile and link it to your latest ideas, perhaps through your blog or your online portfolio. I mean, we know that 100% of recruiters and employers, first thing that they do when they hear about a job applicant or a potential intern is they Google that person. So it's really important to have that effective and inspirational online presence.
Mm. And possibly that it's the Australian way, although I think it might be changing to kind of downplay a little bit. I certainly know I do in my LinkedIn profile. I don't upsell it at all. But you know, I'm of that generation maybe, so that I need to rethink all that. Because we're going to be working till we're 70, isn't that right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And beyond. Yeah.
Oh, you scare me, Ruth. And mildly exhausted. But in the presentation that I you know, first became acquainted with your research, we talked about the way that universities have traditionally cast their role, I suppose, in preparing graduates mm-hmm. and, you know, people at throughout their professional life for the workforce, because we're a university of the real world. And you're suggesting that universities perhaps need to rethink both our role and the way that we approach the learning task. What have you got to share with us about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So traditional university education has been criticised for quite some time, for more than a decade now. The argument is that we tend to turn out what they call I-shaped graduates. So these people with a certain amount of disciplinary depth, but not the capability to move beyond a specific disciplinary area. So these I-shaped graduates are seen as not being particularly employable because they can't transfer their skills into other industries or other kinds of fields.
And even if they are, might say, a double I, meaning the double degree.
Yeah.
It's just like two
exactly.
bodies of technical knowledge.
Yeah. Parallel railway tracks. Yeah. Yeah. And so this has been very strongly criticised for quite some time. And the key response that's come back has been around the T-shaped graduate, which is, you know, you've got some level of disciplinary depth, but also the transferable capability. So things like, you know, written communication, oral communication, informational literacies and so on. Now, my research starts to interrogate this notion as well, and perhaps critique it a little. And I did a study back in 2014, 2015, of outstandingly successful innovative people in STEM, so science, technology, engineering and maths disciplines, and also creative disciplines. They were all Australian, they were all mid-career. I wanted to find out, you know, what makes you outstandingly successful? So what are the capabilities that you have, and how have you acquired those, and what does this mean for higher education? The top finding out of that was that these people were key-shaped people rather than T-shaped people. So key-shaped people are people who have quite diverse disciplinary educational backgrounds. Maybe not necessarily formal education backgrounds, but they do have at least one area of depth discipline-wise. And then they've kept on accumulating various sorts of bodies of knowledge that are quite disparate from what you would think. So, for instance, I had one participant who was a visual communicator, but had a background in maths as well. The reason that this so-called key-shaped person is important is that there are a number of reasons. The first is it affords them a different perspective on disciplinary questions. So instead of being your typical common or garden person in a discipline, applying the same sorts of skill sets and the same sorts of perspectives, they're able to combine different knowledge sets, which gives them an interesting niche. The second thing is they're able to connect with people outside their disciplinary social networks. So this allows them to plug into multidisciplinary team possibilities. Mm. And we know that the way that innovation works is by combining different knowledge regimes and different skill
so
sets.
A link between, you know, for whatever problem they're working on, they're a link between two different disciplines.
Precisely.
Yeah. And we always need someone who can make that bridge,
I think.
Yeah, and bring them two together. Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? And when I heard you say that, I thought of Steve Jobs, who talks about you've got to have a lot of dots to join up, mm-hmm. you know, like to solve some of the big questions. You can't just all have dots, clustered of dots in one area. You've got to have a dispersed range of dots so that you can join them up. Yeah, I think it's so true. My first degree was actually in music before it went to, you know, to obviously to management and other mm-hmm. disciplines. And sometimes I think, oh, my God, why didn't I do economics? That would be so much more useful now. But now I don't regret it. Because I think it does provide that additional dimension. Yeah.
Most definitely. Mm. One of my first degrees was in music as well.
Is that right? Yes. I wish we shared that, didn't you? You're an opera singer.
Yes.
Yeah, that's
yes,
right. It's all coming back to me now. Yeah. And I guess it's because we're both musicians. What does that add? Just, you know, generally that the humanities is a broadening and enriching thing anyway, but there's just a lots of cultural references that become extraordinarily useful.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And also just how to master a specific technical discipline and what's involved in that.
Yeah. Mm. There's musicians tend to have well-developed technical capabilities, and they know how to develop technical capabilities, which is the most important
thing.
Knowing
how to,
yeah.
That's right. Yeah.
And the second thing is about a lot of musicians are very good at maths.
Yeah, I've noticed that. Yeah, it wasn't exactly true for me, but I wasn't bad, but I wasn't excellent either. Yeah, that's true too.
Yeah.
I don't know why that is. It's a certain way the brain develops, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I have heard recently that that someone had said whether young people are going to be capable of doing the what's the 1,000 hours or whatever it is that's going to be involved in learning any sort of technical ability like that. We just don't have the attention span anymore. Mm. I wonder if that's, I hope it's not true. Otherwise, where are we going to get the musicians from?
Definitely. I mean, it's the number that Gladwell,
thank you.
Yeah, popularized is the 10,000 hours.
Thank you.
Yeah,
I was down by 10
by a few thousand. But actually, I mean, what that translates to is, you know, if you pick up an instrument aged 13, by the time you're in your 20s, you should be right.
Mm.
Yeah. Mm. So what I found in my study of outstandingly successful innovative people is that typically they'd had some kind of experience in middle school or just beyond early high school that switched them on to, yeah, I'm really passionate about something, you know.
And it doesn't probably matter what it is necessarily.
Not really. But it becomes about, you know, accumulating those hours and that practice to get that initial disciplinary expertise.
Yeah, so it's learning how to persist with a disciplinary routine, that, and knowing how to learn, it's going to stand you in good stead, I think.
Well put.
Oh, okay. Thank you. I suppose going back to the idea about the I-shaped and the T-shaped, so I think our role here in graduate schools of business is about the spine, about the T. So we think that we take people with disciplinary knowledge, you know, to be, can come from a range of disciplines, you know. You can be come from an engineering background or an artistic background or retail, whatever it is, and we add the spine of the T,
so we
broaden out. But even so, I mean, how we do that, certainly we have a problem-based approach. So
yeah.
I think you advocate that as well. So it's got to start with the challenge. And then people, if I understand your research correctly, the way we naturally seek to learn is to go to our immediate peers to say, how do you solve this problem? And then you find your broader network, so which we try to encourage through, you know, encouraging our students to form mentoring and partnerships and to expand, you know, lift their gaze and expand their social horizon, professionally speaking. But I think we could do even more in that regard about following the natural processes of the way professionals learn. Is that your experience as well? Or is that your advice?
Yeah, definitely. So what you've just described there summarises really very well some of the findings of my research. I'm very interested in what are the optimal ways that people can learn these kinds of skills. So the disciplinary agility and the key-shaped person that I was talking about just before, and things like enterprise and also social network capability and innovation capability. And what my research has suggested is that no matter what the disciplinary area, people tend to prefer to learn hands-on, so in a situated way. So as you say, with a problem, whether or not that's in a small group or individually. And we know this when we reflect on what we do naturally anyway. You know, you get a new iPhone or a new Android phone and you're there, you don't read the book of words first. You'd start pressing buttons.
No, you don't go to the manual.
Precisely. Yeah. And then we turn to our community of practice. Now, typically, this is a group of, you know, 7 to 12 people that we work with fairly closely or we interact with regularly. They might be friends as well or are people who share interests with us. These are our key collaborators. They're our key support people. They're the people that, you know, when you've got an issue, a hairy issue with your phone or with filling out a form, something like this, you're on the phone to them or you're having coffee with them, these sorts of things. They're very important, this community of practice. Where higher education tends to fall down, if I was to name one key area of criticism, is in the third area of learning, and that's the networked learning. So naturally, we all have a much wider network of people with whom we learn and from whom we learn. So these might be people that we're connected with online via social media. They might be acquaintances. They might be friends of friends. They might be users of a particular product, etc. And what we find is that the people who are very, very good at professional learning tend to be connected with a very broad, very diverse network of people. And the beauty of this network is that it's there once you're connected with it. You don't have to do a lot to maintain that network. And yet, you know, if you need that oboe player, or you need the Perl programmer, or the person who can give you a little bit of information about how your oven range hood works, you know, you can go there. Mm. You can go there. They're there. I call it passive with agentic possibility. Mm. So reflecting upon higher education and the way that we tend to do things, we tend to do a lot of stuff in lectures and tutorials, neither of which correspond particularly well to the way that we naturally learn. Mm. And also, we tend to keep our learners behind a walled garden, I suppose, instead of fostering those networks outside that they're going to be using for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, I can see the beauty of that. And I think we're sort of getting there. But I think now that particularly graduate schools and business MBA programs can be accelerators of those kind of processes.
Absolutely, yeah.
And a little bit, you know, sometimes providing those communities of practice, mm-hmm. you know, particularly with the peers in which you engage with your MBA studies or whatever postgraduate endeavour, and also encourage them to look broader, you know, to start building that larger, that third level of network.
Of network, yeah,
and
absolutely.
Going out and finding, and having the courage and resilience to actually go and knock on doors.
Taking your heart in your hands and saying, right, I'm going to make this connection. But this is one thing that I do like about the MBA program. It's that you have the opportunity to build those transdisciplinary networks within the cohort. So you are bumping up against people from all different kinds of backgrounds.
You're right, that is one of
which is what
things.
You need in order to become this key-shaped person. Mm. And it does foster those connections outside.
I think you're absolutely right. So in your new role as dean, that's, I would say, it requires a lot of learning on the job, I would expect.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So how are you going to approach that? What's going to be your learning strategy as you approach this new challenge?
Uh-huh. Good question. Well, I've already started. And the key thing that I've started with is I've started having conversations with people. So I flew down to Adelaide a fortnight ago, and I spent a couple of days at an executive retreat with some of my immediate colleagues. Mm-hmm. And I've actually come up with a conscious strategy there around listening rather than jumping in right away, finding out where the strengths are, checking in, and then maybe coming up with one or two things that I can start with to, I guess, strengthen and capacity build. Beyond that, yeah. Mm-hmm. So I'm still in the phase where I'm figuring stuff out and I'm listening to colleagues and I'm connecting myself.
Connecting, yeah, that's right. And knowing where to go to when you have those questions.
Exactly. It's knowing the people who know the things.
Well, look, we really wish you well on that. But
Thank
we
you.
Always finish with what we call that's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it can come from any range of things. So, I guess if I reflect on, you know, what I've found interesting in the last week or so, I listened to a podcast with Mark Andreessen. So he was the Netscape. He's like a titan of Silicon Valley. And he was, again, reiterating that the pace of technology and change. So he's suggesting that anything that can be software will be software, and I'm thinking that's including education, and that what will follow is that the people with the best software will win when it takes all. The people with the best software will win. So I've been reflecting on that quite a bit, actually, at the moment. What's captured your attention, I guess, in the last week or so? You've been moving, so I imagine lots of things.
Yes, yeah. I'm a little distracted at present. Yeah. So pet moving and boxes and all sorts of things. Let me think about this. What I'm really enthusiastic about, and one of the next things that I want to do, is I actually want to do a research project that looks at how higher education engages with future capabilities. Mm. I really want to have a look at, very systematically, The kinds of capabilities that we seek to develop in our learners, whether undergraduate or postgraduate. I wanted to have a look at the pedagogic approaches that we use. And I want to really interrogate what needs to be human and what needs to be technology enabled. Mm. Because I think that in all of this hype about artificial intelligence and vast processing power, etc., it's easy to get carried away and lose the humanity of it. Mm. Because I think that the future for us is so exciting. It's so exciting. I mean, we're all hearing about media reports saying, 40% of our jobs are going to disappear. Mm. And yet other jobs are being created all the time. Mm. And there's so much possibility out there if we can keep on reinventing ourselves. Mm. And being enthusiastic about our learning.
So, look, you've certainly contributed to our learning on learning. So we wish you huge good luck I congratulate the University of South Australia on their acquisition.
Oh, thank you very much.
And yes. Thank you for making the time, Ruth.
No worries.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Exec Insights. For more information about QUT's executive education programs, please search QUT Executive Education and you'll find a full range of our programs and services.